Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Students, middle school is the place for a number of big changes in their life. A new campus, new teachers, and even new friends. It is also a time when a lot of teenagers try to find out who they truly are, and experimenting in any direction is completely normal. However, sadly, middle school can also be a place where bullies target those who they feel are not conforming to the expected norms. The pressures of fitting in alongside a new environment can often prove to be very difficult for some teenagers, and when prejudice and bigotry go unchecked, it can sometimes lead to violence. The 12th of February 2008 started out just like any other day for the students of E.O. Green Junior High School in Oxnard, California. The first class of the morning for the 8th graders was Dawn Baldwin's English class, and at around 8 a.m. she took her 28 students to the computer lab to work on research papers. Maria and Marina, 8th graders in Baldwin's class, recollect that morning.
Like, I just woke up like it was just another morning. But I was sick. I didn't want to go to school, but I pushed myself to go to school.
I had bought a new sweater the day before, so I was all happy to wear it and stuff. And then Mom drove me to school, gave her a kiss goodbye. Everyone was just hanging out like we usually do before the bell rang.
Things, and then all of a sudden I heard this pop.
Like a loud bang, like a balloon popped.
Around 15 minutes into the class, 14-year-old Brandon McInerney got up off his seat, walked towards the seat of 15-year-old Letitia King, and shot her once in the back of the head. Quote, "Brandon, what the hell are you doing?" end quote, shouted Baldwin. Brandon then looked around the classroom before shooting Letitia in the back of the head once again. He then dropped the gun and walked out of the classroom.
I stood up from my chair and I was able to see over the computer. I just saw his eyes.
I looked at him, he looked at me, and then all of a sudden there was another pop.
He just gave him another one back to head and he dropped. Everyone was screaming, like the kids that have seen it. Like the blood and everything, I guess.
The shots echoed around the school and caught the attention of Dave Rodriguez, the school's counselor. He rushed to the computer lab and immediately began administering first aid to Letitia. As it turned out, the day before the shooting, Brandon had told a female friend that Letitia was, quote, having her last day, end quote. During the school's lockdown, she was overwhelmed with guilt because she hadn't told anybody about the ominous comment. She had just thought that Brandon was joking around. Baldwin ushered the class into another classroom after the shooting out of fear that the shooter would return. By this point, Brandon had taken off running.
911 emergency, this is Mike. You're at E.O. Green School?
Yes. Shots were fired by room 42 on campus.
Do you know where the person with the gun is?
No. Who's the victim? Is there a victim? I'm on the phone with dispatch. Larry. We need an ambulance.
The ambulance is on the way. They should be there staging any time now, okay?
The campus immediately went into lockdown, preventing anybody from entering or leaving within just minutes of the shooting.
30 people come in with a full-on suit and with, like, lights on their helmets and guns. Like, they were pointing them everywhere, and that just even got us more scared.
Police arrived within 5 minutes, and within 7 minutes, Brandon was apprehended by police just a few blocks away. When he was arrested by Officer Joe Tinoco, Brandon said, quote, "I am sorry, I did it, officer," end quote, and told him that he had left the gun at school.
Police in Memphis, Tennessee say they've arrested a suspect in Monday morning shooting at a high school. School officials say the shooting stemmed from a personal dispute between two students. The principal of Mitchell High School says a 12th grader walked into a gym class, shot his victim, and handed the gun to a coach and said, "It's over." Police say the victim was shot at least twice and is in critical condition at a local hospital. The school's principal says the shooting followed some kind of argument that happened over the weekend. Immediately after the incident, the school was put on lockdown and parents were notified. Many soon showed up to take their children home. Ed Donahue, The Associated Press.
Because of his age, Brandon was sent to juvenile hall and held on $770,000 bail. When police arrived at the school, they located Letitia alone in the computer lab, bleeding from two gunshot wounds to the back of her head. Sitting on top of the cabinet, they found the .22 caliber revolver, which had been used. The gun had been dropped by Brandon and then placed on top of the cabinet by Dave Rodriguez, the school counselor who had attempted to perform first aid to Letitia. News of the shooting swept through the city immediately. Huddled behind locked classroom doors, students at E.O. Green were texting each other about what had happened and texting their parents to let them know that they were okay. As the suspect's name was passed from phone to phone, disbelief set in. Brandon's friends all said that no, it could not have been Brandon who committed this murder. But soon enough, Brandon's name was being circulated in the media. With Brandon's name now in the media, his grandfather, William McInerney, said that he had no idea where Brandon could have gotten a gun from. Brandon had been living with his grandfather and his father, who told the media that Brandon was a good kid and he couldn't comprehend what had happened or why. Brandon's half-brothers, James and Jeremy Bing, also shared the same sentiment.
My friend Matt pulled up and came walking in, and I was like, "Hey, how's it going?" And he's like, "There was a shooting at E.O. Green." And I was like, "I know, I heard it on the radio." I was like, "Crazy, huh?" And he was all, Brandon was involved with that. And I instantly thought, like, he was when he got shot. And I'm like, "Is he alive? Is he okay, you know?" And he's like, "No, like, he shot a kid." And I just fell to my knees and started crying. I started screaming, "No." And that's all I really remember, just screaming, "No." And smashing holes and everything.
Long before the school had even notified parents, dozens had already congregated outside the yellow tape that was cordoning off the school. Fear that it was their child who had been shot quivered in the air. By lunchtime, hundreds of parents stretched across two sides of the school's athletic field. They were being consoled by city officials and clergy. News helicopters hovered overhead, recording the scene as it unfolded.
There was a huge line all the way down the street of parents waiting to pick up their children.
Their children could have been hurt.
And yeah. They're just having them wait outside in a line like nothing's happened.
As word of the shooting reached Oxnard Mayor Tom Holden, he cancelled all of his morning meetings at City Hall and headed straight to the school where he spoke with the parents who were now waiting to hear if their children were safe. Letitia was rushed to St. John's Regional Medical Centre in Oxnard, where she was said to be in serious condition. Authorities reported in the media that Letitia was expected to survive. School District Superintendent Jerry Dannenberg said, quote, "It's my understanding that the victim is alert and well in the hospital and talking to police," end quote. The day after the shooting, E.O. Green School was reopened. More than 800 students, some accompanied by their parents, made their way past the numerous television crews that were congregating outside the school. During the morning announcement, students were informed that counsellors would be on hand all day to talk. The school day ran smoothly. Students went to their classes, played sports, and had recess. According to Jerry Dannenberg, the school was, quote, "trying to get back to normal," end quote. However, a dark cloud was looming over. While it was initially reported that Letitia was expected to survive, the following day, Letitia was pronounced brain dead at around 2 p.m. And the following night, she was taken off life support and pronounced dead. Her organs were removed for donation. Her father, Greg King, told the Ventura County Star that it was what she would have wanted. In a sad twist of fate, shortly after Letitia's heart stopped beating in her own body, it was transported into the body of a 10-year-old girl to give her the life that had been cruelly stolen from Letitia. Afterwards, Brandon was charged with first-degree murder and a hate crime.
What's your full name, son?
Brandon.
Is that B-R-A-N-D-O-N? Yes, sir.
Your middle name?
David McInerney.
The main question on everyone's mind was what the motivation behind such a senseless murder could possibly be. The hate crime charged certainly hinted that there was more to this murder than what first met the eye. Classmates of Letitia and Brandon all knew what the motivation was. See, Letitia had developed a bit of a crush on Brandon, but Brandon didn't reciprocate these feelings. Letitia King was born on the 13th of January, 1999, in Ventura County Medical Center. She had been assigned male at birth and had been given the name Larry. That's why during this episode you might hear some people refer to Letitia as Larry or he. However, her preferred pronouns were she, so that's what I'm going to be using throughout the episode. Shortly after her birth, Letitia was adopted by Gregory and Dawn King. Next, we will hear from Ventura County Deputy District Attorney Maeve Fox.
Larry had a very sad and difficult life. He was adopted by people who took his brother as well. But even after he and his brother were adopted, he had a pretty rough life.
At the time of her death, Letitia was under the care of the county foster care system and lived at Casa Pacifica, a center for abused and neglected children.
Larry would go to school and he would keep his jacket on or something. And when he finally took it off or, you know, you saw, he would have bruises everywhere.
The county had been working to get him out. There was like 22 complaints about abuse, and all of them went unfounded. Probation took him out of the home for some bogus vandalism and theft. It was stealing food from their own refrigerator. Yeah.
Casa Pacifica had specialists assist and treat children before a judge decides whether to reunite them with their families or place them in foster or group homes. Letitia was happy here and had made numerous friends and had many people who loved and cared for her. One of Letitia's friends at the center was Richard Gonzalez.
The first time that I met Larry, some kid was over there and the kid said something to him, and Larry got in his face and said, "Hey, I am who I am, so don't, you know?" No, and I ran over there and I got in that kid's face, said, "You know what, just leave this kid alone, you know?" That's when we became friends, you know? We're like brothers, so we look after each other. We would go to get clothes, right, from the front, and donated clothes. He would always go for the girls' clothes for some reason. I'm like, what? I was in the system from when I was 5 to when I was 18. I moved group home to group home, but I always ended up here. At Costa Pacifica, it's home, man. It's home. Larry showed his true self here. He felt comfortable around where he was, so he started coming out.
This is Larry's.
There's this staff member that could sing, you know, she was unbelievably good. So he's like, "Oh, all right." And then he's singing. Oh my gosh, that kid had a voice. It's amazing. Larry was an active kid, always with people, laughing, smiling.
Next, we will hear from Letitia's best friend, Avery Lasky.
When he was at Casa Pacifica, he was the happiest kid. I mean, it was like a total change. I mean, it was amazing. And people like to say, "Oh, it got him more flamboyant. He started dressing out more." No, he started dressing out more because he felt better about himself.
On Friday evenings, Letitia could often be found at the Ventura County Rainbow Alliance office in Ventura, where they held rap sessions for 13-year-olds to 23-year-olds, regardless of their sexual orientation or gender. Those who loved Letitia the most recollected that she was sweet and artistic and always dished out the updates on Project Runway. She loved to sing folk rock songs, enjoyed studying bugs, and often helped out at her younger brother's baseball games. Letitia had a talent in always turning a bad situation upside down and making people feel happy. If Letitia ever had a friend who was feeling down, it was her goal to try and cheer them up. Throughout the last years of her life, she helped her mother to crochet hundreds of scarves for soldiers serving in Afghanistan. Letitia said she wanted to make sure that if the soldiers didn't get a chance to see another Christmas, at least they wouldn't die without receiving gifts from somebody that they were protecting. Seventh grade teacher Sue Crowley recollects the Christmas before Letitia was killed.
At Christmas time, Larry said very shyly, "I've got a present for you." And it was a little blanket and a mouse that he had crocheted for my cat. And I said, "Oh, Larry, that's so sweet." And I opened it in front of him and gave him a hug. My cat didn't show any interest in either item. It's admirable that he was crocheting scarves for the soldiers in the Middle East. But nobody in the seventh grade crochets.
For children and teenagers that live in homes for abused and neglected children, sometimes school can provide them with a daily dose of normalcy and a chance to just be another kid. For Letitia, that just wasn't the case. It was only in the month before her murder that Letitia finally had the courage to show the world her true self. In mid-January, Letitia abandoned the name Larry and began to refer to herself as a she. She got herself a new wardrobe and a bag full of makeup. Letitia's legal guardian at Casa Pacifica, Tracy Carroll, recollects the first time she saw Letitia wearing makeup.
We had one episode during Christmas break where he got makeup. He put it on, it was purple and bright, and oh my God, it was the first time I'd seen him put makeup on. And he goes, "What do you think?" And I go, "I think you look like a clown." And being a woman who puts on makeup, I can tell you that. So we had a VS take him in and really kind of show him how to put it on, but not put it on.
Before heading to school, Letitia would paint her fingernails a hot pink, dab glitter or blusher on her cheeks, and top off her look with red hot lipstick. She teamed her look with her signature pair of black high-heeled boots.
He's a tough kid, pretty strong-willed. And I remember telling him one time, "Larry, you really shouldn't be wearing heeled shoes to school because it's, you know, it's dangerous when you're doing PE. And so he put on tennis shoes and went out the door with me. Little did I know, he had tucked his heels into a backpack.
Her friends all said that the cosmetics only enhanced her quirky personality.
A real family is what he got at Casa Pacifica. And he felt stronger. He wanted to change. Be a new person, and that's who his alter ego was.
The name calling was as routine as maths or English class, and it didn't begin when Letitia showed her authentic self. The taunts began long before Letitia summoned the courage to show herself, and long before she was made a ward of the court. For years, Letitia was mocked for her non-conformist behaviour and endured anti-gay and anti-transgender slurs spewed at her from the classroom to the cafeteria. Nevertheless, Letitia genuinely did not care. Quote, "I am what I am," end quote, she often quipped, always with a smile on her face. During lunch period one afternoon, a student threatened that he was going to take a photo of Letitia and post it on his MySpace, along with the derogative word for gay. Quote, "She said, 'I'm proud. I don't care if other people tease me,'" end quote, recalled 13-year-old Matthew Hernandez.
He wasn't afraid to be who he was. Everyone was making fun of him. I didn't know what my friends would say if they saw me around him. So I just kept my distance.
Letitia made no attempt to hide the fact that she liked boys, and that was something that made some boys in the school feel uncomfortable. Brandon McInerney certainly didn't have a picture-perfect upbringing himself. The McInerney family lived in the same Oxnard neighbourhood that the school was located on. According to court records, Brandon's father, Bill McInerney, had several run-ins with the law in recent years. In 2000, Bill pleaded no contest to disturbing the peace and a few months later pleaded guilty to domestic abuse. He was sentenced to 10 days in jail and 36 months of probation. Then in 2002, he pleaded guilty to drunk driving and driving without a license. He served 5 days in jail and received a fine. Brandon had grown up in Silver Strand, a neighborhood nestled among harbors on each side, where expensive and lavish homes sit alongside ramshackle beach huts. Next, we will hear from Brandon's mother, Kendra.
I was working at a grocery store in Arkansas. I met this truck driver and he was going to Oxnard, California, and wanted to know if I wanted to go, and I said, sure. So I jumped in his truck the next morning and we drove out here. I'd never seen anything so beautiful in my life, and so I went home and got James and Jeremy and moved here. He promised me everything and bought me everything and gave me everything and got married when I was pregnant with Brandon.
Growing up, Brandon appeared to live the life of Riley. He fished from jetties, surfed, and hung out with his friends under the baking sun at the beach. However, behind closed doors, things weren't as picturesque. See, before Brandon was even born, there had been issues between his parents, both of whom abused drugs and alcohol. His mother, Kendra, started using methamphetamine when she was just 20 years old, while his father, Bill, was addicted to prescription drugs.
He seemed totally normal. And then once they got, like, serious, you know, moved in together, that's when it, like, just changed overnight.
We're at one of my friend's engagement parties, and no one really liked him, and so I guess he thought it was a good idea that he take a gun with him to the party. Someone's like, you know, your dude has a gun. You guys need to get out of here. We finally got home, and we started fighting.
We heard him arguing, and me and Jeremy got up, and we, like, went by the door, and, like, I was, like, peeking out. And I could see her, like, walking up the stairs, and he yelled, like, turn around and get back down here. And she was like, no, whatever. And he's like, I'll shoot. And next thing you know, he did. I walked out there, and she was laying on the stairs, and she, like, yelled at me to go back in the room. I could hear Billy, like, on the phone with 911 lying about it. Like, it went off. I didn't mean to. It just went off. They, like, tried to, like, put things over our heads so I couldn't see, but I still saw there was just, like, blood everywhere, all over the wall, all over the stairs. Like, when you have wet shoes on, you hear, like, squish. Like, that's what it sounded like when you were walking down the stairs.
And I found out the bullet went through my arm, through a wall, through a water heater, and landed right next to Jeremy on a pillow. And it was a .45 automatic with a hollow point bullet.
In 1993, a night of partying ended in a fight between his mother and father, and the fight ended with Bill shooting Kendra in the elbow with a .45 caliber pistol. Nevertheless, they married later that year, and then the year after that, Brandon was born. Following his birth, the problems that plagued the relationship just continued. Court documents show that on one occasion, Bill climbed on Kendra's car and reached into its open sunroof in an attempt to grab her as she attempted to drive away. In 2000, Bill pleaded guilty to a domestic battery charge against Kendra and was sentenced to 10 days in jail and ordered to attend domestic violence classes. Shortly thereafter, the couple went their separate ways. The following month, Bill choked Kendra and dragged her outside by the hair. During the fight, Kendra called for Brandon and his two older half-brothers to call for police. Apparently, the fight was over prescription drugs that belonged to one of Brandon's half-brothers. They both accused each other of using the prescription drugs. When police arrived, Kendra told them that there had been numerous other violent incidents between her and Bill. However, she had not reported them to police. Bill was sentenced to 10 days in jail for battery. After the separation, Brandon was split between his parents' homes. Custody agreements changed quite frequently, and a few included conditions that both parents don't use drugs or alcohol while looking after the children, and required that they undergo drug testing at either one's request. On one occasion, when Bill went to pick Brandon up at Kendra's home, he found people passed out on drugs in her living room. Then in December of 2001, Bill filed for a restraining order against Kendra, accusing her of hitting and scratching Brandon. Afterwards, Brandon moved in with his father full-time. In court records, Bill claimed that when Brandon was around 8 years old, Kendra chased after him and Brandon, veering towards them and nearly forcing them into oncoming traffic. A few months later, however, Arrangements changed once again. Brandon's parents signed a custody agreement that Brandon would live with his father and grandfather most of the time and would stay with his mother on weekends. At his father's house, the physical abuse continued.
Any like bruises or anything I ever saw, I always thought was from martial arts. Because he always was like really tough, so I just thought anything was from that. Like I never really thought, I was really innocent in that. It was on 4th of July the first time we drank like a beer, I think. One beer when you're that little, you definitely feel it.
One time he drank, he was like dating Sam, and Billy caught him and punched him in the face right in front of everybody. I found the next day that he had a broken nose, like it's just out of control. And he's like 12 years old. He's getting hit in the face by a grown man.
2 years later, Kendra was charged with drug offenses and ended up in a treatment program, and Brandon finally settled for good at his father's residence, which was just several blocks from E.O. Green School. He lived here with his father and grandfather.
He had Billy up on this high pedestal, and Billy fell off, and he fell off hard and far.
He would seriously take Brandon with him on his drug runs, like when he was smoking crystal meth and stuff, and Brandon would be sitting there in their living room, sleeping. He would, like, crawl under the coffee tables and fall asleep just to, like, kind of be out of sight of everybody.
There was times when I'd pick Brandon up and his knuckles were sore from being out in the front yard, hitting the tree in the front yard. It would be bloody. He wanted out of the house so bad, and every time he was with me, he was begging me to get a place to live so he could come live with me because I lived at the rehab for so long, and I couldn't do it.
Tears were coming down his face, and he was saying how, James, don't make me go home. I don't want to go.
You know, we all got to leave Billy's situation, and he didn't.
So to say the least, life at home for Brandon was filled with trauma and disappointment. He never gained the skills necessary to cope with certain situations. Nevertheless, Brandon was involved in numerous activities outside of the home. He partook in martial arts and lifeguard training. As a young teenager, he joined the Young Marines, and in all likelihood, these activities were a welcome escape from life at home. While Brandon was known to be mostly mellow, following his arrest, a few of his friends recollected that he would never back down from a confrontation. Connie Lawrence, the mother of one of Brandon's friends, said that Brandon alternated between being charming and being a bully. Quote, Brandon picked on what was different, end quote, she said. Letitia made no attempt to hide the fact that she had a bit of a crush on Brandon and that she thought he was cute. Brandon, clearly unsure of how to respond to Letitia's feelings, took to taunting and mocking her. By this point, Letitia had taken to boldly responding to the taunts in school by flirting with the bullies and playing on the sexual insecurity that is common among straight boys. The slurs hadn't fermented the desired reaction of fear and silence, and Letitia's way of responding almost always got the bullies off her back. However, according to Jana Jovanin, a psychology professor at the University of California, unwarranted flirting can often be threatening to someone's ego and their sense of identity. Soon enough, the rumors about Letitia's crush on Brandon were heating up, and kids were beginning to joke that Brandon was gay. While it was clear that Brandon had no romantic feelings for Letitia, she interrupted his basketball game and asked Brandon to be her Valentine. Next, we will hear from Avery, Letitia's best friend.
He had to go up to Brandon, and it just so happened that Brandon's friends were around him. So he got real embarrassed when Larry asked him to be his Valentine.
Just the day before the shooting, several students witnessed Letitia looking at Brandon in class and telling him, quote, baby, I love you, end quote, to which Brandon responded by telling Letitia to fuck off before walking away. Then at lunchtime, Letitia went up to Brandon's table and asked if she could sit down. Brandon and his friends all ran away, laughing at Letitia in the process. Later on in the day, Brandon was bragging about having a gun at home and told one of Letitia's friends, quote, tell Larry goodbye because you're not going to see him again, end quote. According to another student in the school, Brandon and his friends were going to beat Letitia up and stab her because she was, quote, gay and dressed like a girl, end quote. Brandon had also told his girlfriend, Sam, that he was planning to beat up a gay guy in school. Next, we will hear from Sam.
Whenever Brandon talked about Larry, it was about what Larry was wearing, because it really was just weird. It was like off the wall to him. And it was off the wall to me, too. I think Larry was kind of shoving it in everyone's face. For you to come to school dressed like that, you're making a big statement.
On the day of Letitia's murder, she came to school with no makeup or heeled boots. Instead, she wore simple tennis shoes and she had her hair gelled to the side. This was completely out of the ordinary for Letitia, and a number of her friends noticed. Matthew Hernandez asked Letitia what was wrong, but she only replied, nothing.
This is not political, I'm not a political person, but this is personal to me. A boy has been killed and a number of lives have been ruined. And somewhere along the line, the killer, Brandon, got the message that it's so threatening and so awful and so horrific that Larry would want to be his Valentine, that killing Larry seemed to be the right thing to do. And when the message out there is so horrible that to be gay, you can get killed for it, we need to change the message. Larry was not a second-class citizen. I am not a second-class citizen. It is okay if you're gay.
On the Saturday morning following Letitia's murder, around 1,000 people marched in Oxnard in memory of her. The march was arranged by two teenagers that didn't know Letitia but were moved by her story. Quote, I'm so happy. We were expecting a big turnout, but nothing compared to this, end quote, said Courtney LaForest, one of the organizers. LaForest said she had planned the march in the hopes that it would send a message of acceptance. The march began in a park behind E.O. Green School. Marchers donned t-shirts with Letitia's face emblazoned on the front, while others wore clothing promoting acceptance of different genders and sexualities. The march finished in Park Plaza in downtown Oxnard, where they all chanted Letitia's name and observed a moment of silence for her lost life. Several days later, the Gay Straight Alliance held a candlelit vigil to commemorate the life of Letitia and to bring attention to the violence and harassment that LGBTQ members face daily. Quote, it is disheartening to me that all of us in the LGBTQ community, that children and adults alike, cannot be safe from harassment and violence because of who we are as people, end quote, said West Hollywood Mayor John J. Duran. Mayor Duran was a great advocate for the LGBTQ community. He himself was a gay man and also the president of Equality California, which at the time was the largest LGBTQ advocacy organization in the West Coast. West Hollywood Mayor Jeff Prang said, quote, despite the many advances that have been achieved to protect gays and lesbians against discrimination and the changing attitudes of Americans about the LGBTQ community, we are reminded in the wake of this terrible tragedy that there is still profound hatred in our country, end quote. The murder sent shockwaves across the nation and struck a powerful chord among gay, lesbian and transgender advocacy groups, who planned memorials for Letitia all the way from California to Massachusetts. A website was set up to commemorate the life of Letitia, and the emails poured in from countries worldwide. The rain had been hammering down, but just in time for Letitia to be buried, the skies cleared up, and the sun appeared from behind a grey cloud. Quote, I think Larry was shining down on us, end quote, said family friend Phil Cohen. Letitia was buried in a private service, and then on the 22nd of February, hundreds of people crammed into the Westminster Presbyterian Church to pay their final respects to Letitia. The 385-seat building was completely packed, and hundreds of mourners congregated outside, where the emotional service was broadcast over the speakers. Inside, a slideshow chronicled Letitia's short life. Reverend Dan Birchfield described Letitia as thoughtful and quirky, stating that she loved to sing and dreamed of becoming an entomologist. Throughout the service, Georgia Forbes, counselor at Casa Pacifica, burst into tears. She fondly recollected teaching Letitia to roller skate at a rink in Ventura and recalled that she once told her that she didn't understand why people were mocking her in school for being different. Before the service was over, Reverend Birchfield had the mourners sing Amazing Grace, which was one of Letitia's favourite songs. While the shooting of Letitia was the first of its kind in Ventura County, school violence was all too common in the United States. In fact, between the 4th of February and the 14th of February, there had been 6 school shootings. Her shocking death brought scrutiny to how middle schools in Ventura County address and prevent discrimination that can lead to violence. Just the day after her murder, the Los Angeles Times had a quote from another 8th grader that said Letitia's appearance was, quote, "freaking the guys out," end quote. School district officials said they were aware of the tension between Letitia and Brandon and had offered them both counselling. According to Superintendent Jerry Dannenberg, the school had intervention efforts in place to help Letitia, however he refused to discuss specifics. According to some teachers, they believed that Letitia was clearly in violation of the dress code, which prevented students from wearing clothing that was considered distracting. However, legally, they couldn't have stopped her from wearing feminine clothing because of the state hate crime law which prevents gender discrimination. Furthermore, there were numerous girls that wore makeup to class and wore high-heeled boots.
When Brandon told me that Larry came to school in high heels, I was like, why?
I had a black flag. It's this punk rock band. It was a white shirt, but with the black flags underneath, and you could see it through my uniform. And instead of just telling me to take it off, you know, take off your undershirt, they suspended me for it.
I got in trouble for everything. Like, no collar. I would try to go to shirts. I'd try to wear a white, regular white shirt and not have a collar and try to get away with
but
it.
If it's a uniform dress code school, how come that one kid got an exception from everybody else?
Newsweek actually ran a very disrespectful story in the aftermath of the murder, where they accused Letitia of being disruptive and placed the blame of her murder on herself. A lot of people agreed with this perspective of the crime, believing that when Letitia flirted with those who bullied her, she was overstepping the mark. One commenter, called Diva Dawn, stated, quote, "Larry was a bully and was allowed to get away with it, because the school officials were too frickin' afraid to confront him because he was gay," end quote. One can't help but wonder if a cis girl, as in a girl whose gender identity matches the sex that they were assigned at birth, was being extra flirtatious and forward and open with her sexuality and was shot dead by someone who didn't want her attention, would people blame her like people were blaming Letitia? Very unlikely. Many people across the world questioned whether the school could have done anything to prevent the murder. Baldwin suffered tremendously in the wake of the shooting. Next, we will hear her recollect the fateful morning that changed her life forever.
It's your normal day. We all got into the classroom. We'd been working on a paper, World War II essay, for about 2.5-3 weeks. And this was the last day it was due, and I was having them type it, so I had to provide, in essence, the time for the computer in the computer lab, which is, we'd been going back and forth in the computer lab.
And Larry's in your class.
And Larry's in my class.
Where's the other kid?
And Brandon's in my class, too. They actually sat almost in the same row, but Brandon was behind him, and Larry was up in the front.
And he just gets up and does this thing?
Well, that was... I'm talking about my regular class. We'd already walked after, when the shooting happened, we were in the computer lab. And the computer lab is set up just much like a computer lab. Brandon was sitting up towards the door on his own because I didn't allow him to work on the computer that day. He didn't bring his report, so he couldn't work on the computer. Larry was literally sitting in front of him working on his computer.
Did he pull this weapon out of a bag or something?
I didn't even see him pull the gun.
You just heard it.
I was on the other side of the classroom working with another student, and I think out of the side I might have seen an action, but I definitely heard the shot and smelled, you could smell it. It was just like fireworks.
And what did you do?
Then I turned around and yelled at Brandon, and I asked him what the hell he was doing, because I thought he had exploded the computer. And I yelled at Brandon because he was standing. All the other kids are sitting.
When did you first see Larry?
I never saw Larry. I never saw... I don't even know if I saw the gun. I can't actually go through all. So much happened, I still don't even know all that could have happened.
Did you just clear the classroom at that point?
Absolutely.
Once, so that was your next move?
It was after I realized and he fired the second shot and I had yelled at him. He just walked out of the actual classroom. He dropped the gun. That's what they say. The gun was just laying there. And I grabbed those kids and we ran out of the into another hallway.
In an interview with The Star, Baldwin said that Letitia was sweet and kind and had brought her flowers to school on several occasions. Baldwin had bonded with Letitia so much that she even brought her a dress for the upcoming school dance.
I was talking to my daughter, and she had her old homecoming dress. And everybody knows you don't reuse your dresses. So I said, can I give it to Larry? And he loved it. He just loved it. He ran into the bathroom and he tried it on. And he's always, Baldwin, it's a little big, but it fits great. My daughter's exceptionally small and petite. She's like a 00, so that'll tell you how small Larry was.
She was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and learned firsthand about flashbacks and panic attacks that can start with a simple loud noise or nothing at all. She completely lost what used to define her, teaching.
I'd be driving and just start crying. I'm just never going to see the world the way I did before February 12th. If I fall and break my leg, easy. I know what the problem is. But with the post-traumatic, you don't know what's going to set it off. My family couldn't handle it. They couldn't handle the anxiety, the crying, the despair. I had overdosed on drugs. I had tried to commit suicide. And I almost did it because I was on life support for 3 days.
Unable to come to terms with what had happened in her classroom, Baldwin lost her job, was hospitalized after a suicide attempt, and couldn't afford to cover her medical expenses. The shooting prompted Assemblyman Mike Eng to introduce legislation that could prevent hate crimes against children in school. He unveiled a plan for a bill that would promote tolerance among students, teachers, parents, and administrators. These programs were to encourage students to learn about and accept differences in sexual identity and would guide teachers and administrators on when to report bullying to law enforcement. The district attorney decided to try Brandon McInerney as an adult.
I just knew right off the bat that they were going to try him as an adult. In my head, as soon as I heard it, I was like, yeah, like he's going to jail for the rest of his life. And then he kept saying, it's like he'll never be able to love a girl, you know, or he'll never be able to, you know, get drunk and do something stupid. You know, like he never even got in trouble before. There's so many things he never got to do, you know, like he never got to drive a car or, you know, ditch school. Like just constantly kept running through my head as all the things that he'll never be able to do.
This decision wasn't uncommon in Ventura County. In the past 2 years, the number of juveniles being tried as adults had almost tripled from 10 in 2006 to 27 in 2007. The first-degree murder charge carried a prison sentence of 25 years to life, while the hate crime charge could add up to 3 years to the sentence. While a convicted juvenile could only be incarcerated until they are 25 years old for the same crime. The decision for Brandon to be tried as an adult renewed the arguments over Proposition 21, which is the state ballot measure that was passed in 2000. Proposition 21 gives prosecutors sole discretion on whether juveniles 14 years old or older who commit serious crimes could be tried as adults in adult court. Those who supported Proposition 1 said they felt as though prosecutors should have more power when it comes to dealing with gang members.
Prop 21 intended to address this rather dramatic uptick in juvenile violence in the gang context because a lot of the peewees, as their older brethren call them, were put up to the task of committing these violent crimes because they knew they would only go into the juvenile facility where they would receive a mild slap on the hand and they would be out on the streets within a very short period of time.
Those who opposed Proposition 21 argued that minors do not yet have the mental development and maturity to fully comprehend their actions and the crimes that they commit. Experts have long asserted that children cannot be expected to achieve the same level of psychological and neurological development as adults. Even teenagers lack the same capacity as adults to use reason, judgment, and to understand long-term consequences of their actions. A number of people were outraged with the decision and called for Brandon to be tried as a juvenile. In fact, the National Centre for Lesbian Rights and Transgender Law Centre asked District Attorney Greg Totten to try Brandon as a juvenile, stating, "We call on prosecutors not to compound this tragedy with another wrong." They called for Brandon to be held responsible for his actions, but said they supported the principles underlying the juvenile justice system that treats children different to adults, to provide a greater hope and opportunity for rehabilitation. If the shooting had taken place just 19 days earlier, then Brandon would have been 13 years old and would have been ineligible to have been tried as an adult. Brandon would have to be tried in the juvenile court system and would then be sentenced to the California Youth Authority, where he would most likely be educated, rehabilitated, and then released back into society as a grown man who paid his debt for the crime he committed as a child. Unfortunately for Brandon, however, that wasn't the case. And if found guilty as an adult, Brandon would be facing a life sentence. Brandon's defense attorney, William Quest, said that Brandon should not be tried as an adult and that the murder could have been avoided. He said that E.O. Green's administration knew all too well about the simmering tensions between Letitia and Brandon, yet allowed the situation to fester. Quest argued that the school administrators supported one student expressing herself, but ignored how it affected the other students. This was something that the school, of course, denied. Robin Bransom and Scott Whipper were two of Brandon's defense lawyers, and they worked on his case pro bono.
I didn't know anything about it until I read a little article. You know, he's 14, and then it was a classmate, and that it was charged as a hate crime, and that he was looking at life in prison. I was like, we should try to help this kid. Scott was working for United Defense Group, and his boss said, yeah, we can do it pro bono, and then we just kind of sought out to help the family.
Our passion is helping children and the juveniles. Delinquency arena, and especially those that are charged as adults. It used to be that they would have a fitness hearing, the juvenile's background, mental health issues. The idea behind it is to rehabilitate, not to punish.
But Prop 21 just cut that whole process out.
A lot of people thought that this was for gang kids. I don't think anybody anticipated that it would be used in the way that it's being used now. But taking a 14-year-old who's barely, 19 days after his 14th birthday and making that snap decision, we're going to charge it as an adult because we can.
Every single adult just fucked up everything at every step of the way and continues to. And that's, I think, what's so frustrating for me. No one noticed for years and years, and now we just want to say, sorry, adult.
In August, Brandon pleaded not guilty to premeditated murder and a hate crime. After entering the plea, Quest equated the charges to a death sentence. Shortly after his plea, it was publicly revealed that a number of guns were easily accessible in Brandon's home. Ventura County Deputy District Attorney Maeve Fox describes the search.
Oxnard Police detectives obtained a search warrant for the residence, which belonged to Brandon's grandfather. The grandfather's room had a couple of long guns, and then there were a number of handguns. There was ammunition as well placed on the top shelf of Brandon's bedroom.
Also among his possessions, they found numerous items of white supremacist literature and drawings, including drawings of swastikas and references to the 14 words and the number 88.
When I first looked at these drawings, the first page, when we start seeing lightning bolts, is it doodling? Is it okay? when I started getting a little farther into the notebook where I was noticing drawings that stood out to me to be unusual, this particular image was the most disturbing for me. Seeing the hand crushing the Star of David and the blood coming from it, its cracks, it's hard because I know Holocaust survivors. This is a very, very strong message. This is very, very powerful. To me, this is somebody who'd want to see this happen again.
It was this discovery that played a significant role in the district attorney's decision to charge Brandon with a hate crime. Then the following month, a judge appointed a psychiatrist and psychologist to evaluate Brandon. His lawyers, Whippert and Bramson, filed a motion requesting Brandon undergo psychiatric evaluation to determine whether he was competent to stand trial and whether he had the ability to understand the nature of the criminal proceedings and assist his lawyers. After evaluation, Ventura County Superior Court Judge Kevin McGee ruled Brandon competent to stand trial. While the courts were still grappling with Brandon's faith, Letitia's parents, Dawn and Greg King, filed an 18-page lawsuit against a number of defendants, including Brandon and his family, the school, Child Protective Services, the Casa Pacifica Shelter, and the Ventura County Rainbow Alliance, where Letitia found solace. They accused the school and Casa Pacifica of knowing about Letitia's, quote, sexually assertive and threatening, end quote, behavior at school, yet said they failed to take appropriate action. They also accused Casa Pacifica of providing Letitia with, quote, cross-dressing clothes and makeup and women's boots, end quote. They also accused the Ventura County Rainbow Alliance of encouraging Letitia to make sexual advances on Brandon, something which the Alliance flatly denied, quote, no facilitator or mental health therapist would ever say anything even remotely like that. This whole thing is frivolous, end quote, said Jay Smith, executive director of the Alliance. They were seeking general but unlimited damages against all defendants, with punitive damages against Brandon. A preliminary trial was scheduled for March of 2009.
The father of Brandon McInerney, the Oxnard boy accused of killing a classmate, was found dead this morning, just hours before his son was to appear in court.
When a friend of Brandon's father, Bill McInerney, arrived at his home to drive him to the courtroom, he discovered Bill dead on the floor.
The medical examiner says the 45-year-old died from a blunt force head injury related to alcohol. A toxicology report is pending.
Dr. Janice Frank, the Ventura County Assistant Medical Examiner, concluded that Bill had died from an accidental fall and said that a contributing cause of death was alcoholism. After getting word of Bill's death, Judge James Collinger postponed the hearing until April. Following Bill's death, Brandon was allowed to attend his funeral.
The day he died, I put the biggest smile on my face. I didn't give shit, you know? Like, I cried when I had to be the one to tell Brandon, you know? I honestly felt that way.
And even when James told Brandon, the first thing Brandon said was, I knew it was going to happen, I just didn't know when.
Finally, in June of 2009, almost a year and a half after the shooting of Letitia, the preliminary trial began. District Attorney's Office Investigator Robert Coughlin testified that he had interviewed a number of Letitia and Brandon's classmates to piece together the events that unfolded in the classroom on that fateful morning. He recollected how one girl said that she started a conversation with Letitia shortly before her murder and asked her to confirm that she had changed her name from Larry to Letitia. She said that afterwards, the boys in the class began to laugh before Letitia questioned, "What are you laughing at?" Moments later, the class heard one pop and saw Letitia slide down from her seat. The class all looked to the direction of the sound and saw Brandon lift the gun up once again and fire a second shot into Letitia's head. Detective Dan Swanson, a gang expert, testified that Brandon was deeply entrenched in white supremacist ideology and identified Letitia as the enemy of the white race due to her sexual identity and race. Brandon's defense lawyers tried to portray Letitia as a troubled and sexual aggressor who taunted boys with flirtatious remarks and gestures. They also tried to claim that Letitia, who stood at 5 feet 4 inches tall and weighed only 111 pounds, was a schoolyard bully. This was something that Baldwin, the teacher whose classroom the shooting took place in, completely refuted. She said that Letitia was shy and feminine. According to Baldwin, Brandon had once said to her that he was going to be a skinhead and join the white power movement. Next, we will hear from forensic psychologist, Dr. Donal Hoagland.
What Larry was doing to Brandon was an extreme form of bullying. It was an extreme form of sexual harassment. When playing basketball at lunch, Larry had wobbled onto the court, interrupted the game in front of all Brandon's basketball buddies and ask him if he would be his Valentine. To have any guy ask you that in front of all your peers, but to have a guy who's wearing high heels and makeup, that would be like the ultimate humiliation. It was very disturbing to all the boys, and so they, you know, kind of talked about it in a guy way, macho way. It's bad enough to have this kid who wears girls' clothes, you know, breaking all the rules, but then, you know, guys don't hit on guys. If you want to really insult a guy, you call him gay. Brandon was thinking that he needed to get rid of Larry. He needed to save everyone from this, you know, this scourge that had come up on the school.
Judge Ken Riley determined that there was enough evidence for Brandon to go to trial. The trial was slated for July of 2011, 3 years after the shooting.
I'm afraid of people who feel very strongly that juveniles should not be tried as adults because they want to be on the case so bad that they'll lie in jury selection when you ask them their feelings about a certain subject. And I'm really afraid of the stealth homosexual haters in this case. I believe they're going to present some kind of a gay panic defense that somehow Larry King, based on what he did or said, provoked Brandon into doing what he did.
The prosecution was going to argue that Brandon was a white supremacist who killed due to his beliefs, while the defense was going to argue that Brandon came from a household fraught with abuse and violence, and that Brandon had killed Letitia in a crime of passion. During opening statements, Ventura County Deputy District Attorney Maeve Fox said that Brandon had acted on the white supremacist philosophy that homosexuality is an abomination. However, defense attorney Scott Whippert refuted these claims, instead stating that Brandon had reached an emotional breaking point over the unwarranted sexual advances by Letitia and that he should be convicted of manslaughter. Fox told the jurors that they wouldn't be presenting any evidence about Letitia's sexual orientation, but instead, students would be testifying about the rocky relationship between Brandon and Letitia. One by one, students took to the stand to recollect what happened on the morning of the shooting. Many broke down as they recalled how Letitia was often mocked and taunted for her appearance and demeanor. A number of students testified that they had never seen Letitia be sexually aggressive to anybody. One student, identified only as Keith L., testified that Brandon said he was going to bring a gun to school after Letitia called him baby in a crowded hallway at school. Keith said he never reported the comment because he had assumed that Brandon was only joking around. There were five other people who testified that they had heard Brandon threaten to kill Letitia.
Day two took such an emotional turn that we're told the bailiff had to keep restocking the courtroom with facial tissue because of all the tears. About a half a dozen students testified saying the same thing, that King was a loner who was ignored until he came out and started wearing makeup and heels, and that other students randomly mocked him. One of them, though, that had the most riveting testimony was a girl known simply as Mariah T. She was a friend of Larry King's, was also sitting behind him when those fatal shots rang out.
Just spell your name.
M-A-R-I-A-H.
Thank you. Miss Fox?
Mariah, do you remember that morning?
Yeah.
What did you see? What happened? Breathe. You okay? You want to take a break, Mariah?
Why don't we take a break?
When Dawn Baldwin entered the courtroom to testify, she and Brandon smiled at one another. It was the first time that they had seen each other since the shooting in her classroom. Baldwin said that Brandon was always a good kid who didn't cause any trouble in class. She said that she had given Letitia makeup tips in the past and that she always stuck up for Letitia when she heard boys making fun of her. Quote, "You should support people in their differences because it takes a lot of guts to be different in today's world, especially in 8th grade," end quote, she said. According to Baldwin, shortly before Letitia was killed, she confided in her that her parents had been abusing her. This was something that Letitia's parents staunchly denied. Whippert contended that Letitia had sexually harassed boys and that she was empowered to make unwanted advances because the school administrators were willing to look the other way. Joe Epstein, the former vice president of E.O. Green School, said she warned Letitia that dressing differently could make things difficult for her among the boys in the school, but said that she didn't discourage her because the way she dressed didn't violate the school's dress code. Epstein came under fire for allegedly being more concerned about defending Letitia's civil rights than recognizing her behavior was making people uncomfortable. A number of teachers testified about Letitia's appearance, and several said that Epstein was not doing her job as an administrator if she did not see that Letitia's clothing and behavior was upsetting some of the members of staff and students.
The week before the shooting, I had an epiphany. I was out monitoring the students after school, and I saw this pretty little girl, and she had really short hair with these dangly pretty earrings and these high-heeled boots and beautiful little figure. And then she turned around and I saw it was a boy. It clicked. This is Larry, and this is what all the rumblings are about, and now I understand.
He came into my classroom before school with makeup on. I told him he needed to wash it off because we were working on these behavior issues. He wasn't supposed to draw attention to himself, and wearing makeup as a boy is definitely drawing attention to yourself.
I saw Brandon sitting on the bench, very angry and upset. Brandon's friends that were laughing at Brandon. That's when I first noticed Larry. He was kind of parading back and forth. It seemed like he was trying to get Brandon's attention.
Shirley Brown, a 7th grade teacher, testified that she complained about Letitia to the head principal. Quote, "I said something to the effect of, gay rights, what about the rights of 6th, 7th and 8th graders who come here and are not ready for this information?" End quote. She also confessed that on one afternoon, she saw a group of boys chasing Letitia, but said she didn't step in to help her or stop the boys.
I had Larry as a student the previous year as a 7th grader. And I knew his inclination. He had discussed it with me. When he asked me what to do about the situation, my response to him was, nothing. What to do about this situation is nothing. And to keep it private and to dwell upon it. Larry shouldn't have expressed himself so blatantly, openly transsexual. He progressed day by day in his outward appearance as a girl. Any teacher with a grain of salt, really said, it's out of control. I do believe in a heaven and a hell. And I do believe Larry honestly did not even have a clue the consequences of his actions. I relate to Brandon because I could see my own self being in that very same position. I don't know if I would have taken a gun, but a good swift kick in the butt might work really well. After Larry's death, a gay pride rainbow group of about 1,500 people are marching down C Street right in front of our school. Now, who orchestrated that gay pride? In 14 years of teaching there, never seen that. Never seen it in the city of Oxnard, and right in front of our school? What is that?
In fact, Shirley Brown was a staunch defender of Brandon and readily excused his Nazi-related drawings.
The doodling that I saw in my kids' notebooks were really very interesting, but the swastika they would copy, and those who are artistically inclined, the whole Adolf Hitler with the mustache and the hand and the Heil and, walking into class after being taught some of these things the very next day, be perfectly normal. Heil! For kids to come in and say, Heil!
According to Letitia's 7th grade special education teacher, Susan Crowley, Letitia desperately wanted to be liked, but didn't have the social skills to get along with people her age. Quote, She often said things that were one note off the mark, end quote, she recalled. She also said that Letitia couldn't quite distinguish between positive and negative attention and just wanted people to give her attention. Crowley also said that she didn't believe that Letitia's behaviour was being adequately addressed by school administrators. Drawings of swastikas and other racist logos, white power images, and books about the SS and Iron Cross were introduced as evidence during the trial. Investigator Robert Coughlin testified that Brandon's mother had sent him a Confederate flag while he was in juvenile hall. The defense attempted to chip away at the claim of a hate crime. Wippert alleged that Brandon was not racist or a white supremacist, but instead was just interested in German history and had been writing about Hitler as part of a class on tolerance. The defense also said that the Nazi books and Iron Cross medal found in Brandon's bedroom actually belonged to his brother. One of the most focal points of the trial was Brandon's upbringing. His half-brother testified that they endured beatings from their out-of-control, drug-addicted father. James Bing said that he and Brandon were often beaten, slapped, and kicked by their father. He recollected how Bill put Tabasco sauce in their mouths while they were asleep and attacked them with a bar of soap stuffed into a sock. Brandon's aunt, Megan Corba, also testified about Brandon's traumatic upbringing. She recollected how Brandon was just 7 years old when he was first punched in the face by his father. She said that Bill's wrath put towards his son only increased when he was on drugs. Corba told the courtroom that while Kendra was pregnant with Brandon, she smoked crystal meth. She said that the day before Letitia's murder, Brandon tried to talk to his father about something that was going on at school, but Bill was on a drugs binge and semi-conscious on the sofa. It was also revealed that when Brandon was a young boy, he had been sexually molested by his cousin. Bing said that before Brandon's father, Bill, died, he had suggested that the sexual abuse played a part in Letitia's murder. The defense wanted to persuade jurors that Brandon was not filled with hate-based bias against Letitia, but instead that he was a victim of a violent upbringing and was unable to articulate his rage and frustration to unwanted advances from Letitia. Tensions in the courtroom were high throughout the trial. Letitia's mother, Dawn, was banned from most of the trial after calling Baldwin's 13-year-old daughter a derogatory name. Throughout the trial, one of Brandon's defense lawyers, Robin Branson, wore a bracelet which read, "Save Brandon." Fox contended that the bracelet was inappropriate and unprofessional, given the fact that Brandon had murdered Letitia. There were no questions about his guilt. The entire classroom had witnessed it.
He did not pull a Columbine. He did not go and shoot everybody he could. He shot Larry King because he didn't know what else to do to make it stop. But he's not a murderer. When you make this decision, use your common sense, use your heart, use your soul, and remember that he was 14.
During closing arguments, defense lawyer Scott Wippert said that Brandon had reached an emotional breaking point after weeks of being sexually harassed by Letitia. They said that Brandon snapped when he heard Letitia speaking about her new name in class and argued that he should be convicted of manslaughter.
Mr. Wippert just asked you to violate the law, you know, use your heart, and 39 times he reminded you that the defendant was a 14-year-old boy. We talked about the fact that it's going to be difficult and that your emotions come in, but you have to check them at the door. The law requires you to do that. There is absolutely no way that the facts of this case could ever be voluntary manslaughter because no reasonable average person would ever do what the defendant did. And it's sad. It is. It's tragic. It's awful. It's also a done deal.
In her closing argument, District Attorney Maeve Fox told jurors that Letitia was executed for being who she was, and that the crime was therefore first-degree murder. Quote, "No amount of revisionist history and attempts to paint Larry King as some kind of predator can ever change the fact of what occurred in this case. That is, Larry King was executed for who he was," end quote, said Deputy District Attorney Maeve Fox. She said that Brandon had told friends that he was planning on killing Letitia and that he had brought a gun to school that morning. Now, it was up to the 9 women and 3 men to decide Brandon's fate. However, after 3 days of deliberation, Judge Charles Campbell declared a mistrial after the jurors were unable to reach a unanimous decision on the degree of Brandon's guilt. 7 were in favour of voluntary manslaughter, while 5 others supported first-degree or second-degree murder. Instead of going through a retrial, Brandon pleaded guilty to second-degree murder, voluntary manslaughter, and use of a firearm, and was sentenced to 21 years in prison. Brandon did not get credit for the 4 years of jail time he had already served, and is not able to get out early on good behaviour. He will be 39 years old when he is released. Still young enough to have a career and a family, something he completely denied Letitia. Following the trial, documentary makers for Valentine Road caught up with 3 of the jurors, who seemingly had quite the soft spot for Brandon.
We bonded because it was so frustrating to hear things in court, and there were times we were all crying in court, and we couldn't talk about it. Brandon's an intelligent kid. Everybody said it.
You know, I feel he's an intelligent, but I feel he's such a kid.
He's immature.
I feel, you know, when I looked at him and he was sitting at that table, my heart broke for him as a mom and a grandmother.
Not one of us thought he was a white supremacist.
Never.
Now, his assignment on Adolf Hitler. Could it have sparked his interest and thought, oh, wow, I want to know a little more about this. He's 14,
that's
of course
right, he's
it did.
A kid.
It did.
And they love to draw at that
yes,
age.
Yes, they doodle right.
And he's combining
and
symbolism.
Yes,
and
I doodle now. Especially when I'm not happy about what I'm hearing and my hands go faster and faster.
Where are the civil rights of the one being taunted by another person who's cross-dressing? They have to address that. It's very important.
Clearly that wasn't addressed.
No, it wasn't. And yes. He had no one he could turn to because the school was so pro Larry King civil rights. But where was Brandon's civil rights?
It was the high heels. I think it was the makeup, the behavior.
Because Marina?
Yes. She had a girlfriend. They were told not to hold hands in school, so they stopped.
She got it.
She exactly.
Larry didn't
did get it.
And had he followed her example,
we wouldn't be here today. Yeah.
From behind bars, Brandon earned his high school diploma. Afterwards, he wrote a letter to Baldwin.
First thing, I got it in the mail. I did not open it. I was too scared. That's cool you found out about my graduation. I would have been an idiot not to try and get my diploma. I can't tell you enough how sorry I am for all the pain and guilt I've caused you. But I need you to know none of this is your fault at all. It is no one's fault but my own. Please know that. And I'm definitely not angry with you. And I never was. I've moved on from what happened. And I hope I can help you do the same. Love, Brandon.
Over 10 years have passed and everything in the fabric of A.O. Green School has completely evolved for the better. The Star published an article which said that now, E.O. Green School is a place of acceptance and inclusion, and a place where everybody has taken an unspoken vow to prevent a repeat of the horror that unfolded on the 12th of February 2008. Today, E.O. Green School even has their own gay-straight alliance called PRISM. The alliance meets weekly in a bid to create a safe, diverse, and welcoming space for LGBTQ kids and their allies.
When you ask me if Larry died in vain, the answer to that, with or without any trial, is yes. He simply shouldn't have died. The trial of Brandon McInerney is neither here nor there when it comes to Larry's death. It highlights how intolerant we are, that intolerance is to such a degree that people bring it with them wherever they go, even in the jury box. And until we become a little more forgiving, a little more open-minded, I think, as a society, then tragic events like this will continue to be in vain.
There are no winners in this case. Some look at Letitia King as a sexual harasser, while others say that she was simply retaliating to the bullying that she was forced to endure. Whatever your opinion, Letitia was not the sole victim in the classroom on that fateful morning. Brandon McInerney, too, was a victim of his violent and dysfunctional home. Letitia's murder really brought home just how imperative it is for parents and teachers to educate their children and students about acceptance, understanding, and compassion. It also highlights the difficulties that teachers face when it comes to protecting legitimate and personal expression while also preventing inappropriate behavior. There were so many missed opportunities to prevent the murder of Letitia, and one can't help but wonder if the adults in this situation, the parents and the school administration, had have acted accordingly, then would Letitia still be alive and Brandon a free man? Well guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to give a big massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Emma and Daniel and Clara Broden. Morbidology is a one-woman team, so the support really does go a long way in helping the podcast to continue and grow. I'd also like to thank everybody that has taken the time to leave a kind review on iTunes, and everybody that has simply listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode. I really do appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. We also have a podcast promo at the end of this episode for the amazing true crime podcast Beyond the Rainbow, so please stay tuned for that. Until next time, take care of yourselves and have an amazing week.
Hey there, Rainbow Warriors. I'm CJ, host of a new podcast called Beyond the Rainbow, True Crimes of the LGBT Community. In this podcast, we cover cases not so well known, as well as more notorious ones. A lot of interesting info mixed with a little bit of snark, but always focusing on the empathy I feel for the victims. Please give us a listen on your favorite podcast app. Push subscribe. And remember, it's not a crime to be gay. Unless you're a murderer.